Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour's Editorial Review. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour's Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Editorial Review and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events in the light of Bible prophecy, biblical law, and scriptural history, so stay tuned for tonight's reports right after this message. Well, back in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child in the world. But today, it's down to less than 38 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Now, we Americans, for instance, produce grain for export, but then we turn around and import grapes from Chile, tomatoes from Mexico, and berries from Guatemala. Now, our food supply is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support this Global 2000 population reduction program. Globalization may be good for business, but globalization is not good for you, and it's not good for me. Now, back in 1940, we all had a pantry full of food to feed our families for a year or more, and today we now have a three-day supply in our refrigerators, and we've been taught to believe in our supermarket system of just-in-time delivery to feed us. So over the past 60 years, we Americans have traded a one-year food supply for about 3 days. And these global 2,000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians plan to use famine, plague, disease, and pestilence to reduce Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years, or so says the Club of Rome. Now, these evil madmen with their global 2,000 genocide agenda have a case and a clause, a cause that they're willing to die for, and I say let them die for their cause. Unless you and I live for our cause. And let me show you from the scripture how to be a live survivor instead of a dead victim. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Remember, my subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Click on to the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember now, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, Afghan opium production has doubled. Have you ever wondered why the markets are doing so well? Well, we've documented for years with almost $600 billion in drug money being laundered through Wall Street and U.S. banks and markets. Our market should be improving. Now, according to CNN, opium production in Afghanistan is 36 times higher than at the end of the Taliban rule. Not every U.S. policy overseas is a failure. Hamid Karzai controls a few square blocks of Kabul, Afghanistan, but the CIA-controlled warlords control the real estate that really matters. Now, the Afghanistan poppy production has doubled. Poppy cultivation in Afghanistan doubled between 2002 and 2003 to a level 36 times higher than in the past or in the last year of the Taliban rule, according to White House figures released Friday. The area planted with poppies used to make heroin and morphine was 152,000 acres in 2003, compared with 77,000 acres in 2002 and only 4,000 acres in 2001. The White House official, or Office, rather, of National Drug Control Policy said in a statement. Let me pause here and let's take this into perspective. You know, the Muslims don't produce these poppies because they say these drugs violate the Quran. So when the Taliban, these radical, fanatical, crazy, off the wall, religious nuts were in control of Afghanistan, they outlawed the production of opium poppies, and there was only 4,000 acres under cultivation under the Taliban. Now, at the end of 2001, the United States went into Afghanistan, threw the Taliban out, and we took over. So the very next year, in the year 2002, the cultivation of poppies increased from 4,000 to 77,000. Let me just take 77, divide that by 4. So it went up nearly 20 times. I put in 20 times the acreage in just 1 year, the very next year. Now it's gone from 76,900 acres, 77,000 acres, to 152,000 acres in 2003. You can rest assured that the cultivation of poppies in the year 2004 is going to be higher than it was in 2003. Now, I wonder why it is the United States of America can't control the production of opium poppies in Afghanistan, and the Taliban could, you know, the religious nuts. They could do it, but we can't. Now, the Taliban was cracking down on poppy production in the year before the U.S. military drove the movement out of office in late 2001 in response to its friendship and cooperation with the Al-Qaeda organization of Osama bin Laden. The new Afghan government, led by President Karzai, has not been able to impose its will in many areas of the country, which remain under the control of the warlord. The White House statement said that a challenging security situation has complicated significantly the task of implementing counter-narcotics assistance programs and will continue to do so for the immediate future. Poppy cultivation in Afghanistan is a major and growing problem. Drug cultivation and trafficking are undermining the rule of law and putting money in the pockets of terrorists, it added, quoting the office director, John Walters. The U.S. figures differ significantly from those released a month ago by the United Nations, which estimate that poppy cultivation rose 8% in 2003 to 200,000 hectares from 185,000 in 2002. Oh. Well, let's plug those numbers in. The United States is telling us that in 2003 that 150,000 acres, but the U.S. figures differ significantly from those released a month ago by the United Nations, which estimated that poppy cultivation in 2003 rose to 200,000 acres. Now, that's 25% higher than the White House admits to. They said in 2002 there was only 77,000 acres. The United Nations says there was 185,000. Now, the White House said that the United Nations used a different method based on a mixture of ground surveys and analysis of imagery from commercial satellites. The United States estimates are based on a sample survey of Afghan agricultural regions conducted with specialized U.S. government satellite imaging systems, and added that the United States and the United Nations also give different estimates for Afghanistan's opium production in 2003. The United Nations said it would rise 6% to 3,600 metric tons, while the White House said 2003 output would be 3,000 metric tons. The United States did not give a 2002 figure. Opium production complicates the task of restoring central government authority in Afghanistan because it enables the warlords to run small armies and give them an extra financial incentive to retain their autonomy. Well, listen, let me tell you a little story about those satellites. Those satellites are so accurate that they can identify the crops that are growing. For instance, they can take a look with a satellite image of corn growing in Nebraska or Iowa. They can tell you that it's corn, and they can tell you what the expected yield is going to be off of that corn from those satellite images. Now, when CNN comes in and gives us a report and says, gee, we're not quite too sure how much opium they're growing there in Afghanistan, but hey, maybe we think that it could be, they can tell you exactly how many acres are planted. And they can tell you what the expected return is going to be. And that's because the United States is fostering, encouraging, allowing the growth of those poppies. You see, it's a part of the world drug supply. The Taliban had two things working against them. They shut off heroin. That's a no-no. And they shut off the oil pipeline from the Caspian Sea to India. That's a no-no. They're not going to sit still for that. Now, that's why we went to war in Afghanistan. All right, so there's that story for you. Just wanted you to know that the opium supply is back up to its pre-war level. And that's good for our economy. Here's a story on dangerous spiders. You ever heard of a brown recluse spider? Well, the brown recluse spider that bit 7-year-old Pettigrew resident Brookline Evans last month is likely to have more relatives than usual this year. The lack of continuous deep freeze nights last winter will make the spiders, as with ticks, more prevalent this year. Dr. Collis Green, no, it's Guerin, G-E-R-E-N, Guerin, University of Arkansas Dean of Graduate School and the Vice Provost for Research, said that he's been chasing that spider for more years than I want to remember. In fact, Guerin has spent some 30 years doing research on the brown recluse toxin. Evans was bitten either in her sleep or as she was getting ready for school. Shortly after, she began to itch in the area near her left breast. Her urine had blood in it. By the time she was rushed to Washington Regional Medical Center in Fayetteville, her kidneys had begun the process of shutting down. Now, she should spend 8 days in the ICU at Arkansas Children's Hospital in Little Rock, improving only after dialysis was started, and the ordeal left her hospitalized for 11 days. Now, I've had more phone calls this year than usual regarding these spiders, Guerin said. Most people don't respond to that dramatically. Most don't even know that they've been bitten. Hang on, we'll be back after this break. I'll tell you the rest of the story on brown recluse spiders right after this. All right, we're back. You're listening to the Law Hour's Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. All of these Editorial Review programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. You know, in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Today, it's down to less than 38 days. And the global 2000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians plan to use famine, disease, plague, and pestilence to reduce the Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years under the Club of Rome plan. You know, in Revelation 6, God told us exactly the same thing in essentially the same words, using false prophets, war, famine, and disease. Now, back in the early 1920s, nearly 50% of our people lived on the land as subsistence farmers, producing their own food, food for the rest of the world and for you and me. Now, today, we Americans have chosen to live in our cities, and now only 3% of us live on the land. 97% of us, then, are no longer self-sufficient in our food production. Now, we produce grain for export, all right, and then we import grapes from Chile, tomatoes from Mexico, and berries from Guatemala. Our food supply is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support this global 2000 world population control program. These globalists, with the genocide agenda have a cause that they're willing to die for, and I say let them die for their cause, and let's you and I live for ours. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. That number is 417-273-4967. My subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about brown recluse spiders. Now, I've had more phone calls this year than usual regarding these brown recluse spiders, Garen said. Most people don't respond that dramatically. Most don't even know that they've been bitten. Nevertheless, Garen said precautions should be taken. As a full-grown adult, the brown recluse can fill up the width of a half dollar with its legs, according to Green. And it has a vacuum cleaner as a spider's worst enemy. Garen said the spider often found in a bathtub or shower area is a brown recluse. Unlike most spiders, a brown recluse does not have suction cups on its feet, and it cannot climb the porcelain. Now, the spider does not attack people and will bite only if it is threatened. And Evans said he believes Evans likely rolled over on one during her sleep. Now, these spiders don't stop and bite you, Garen said. On the other hand, if you're stupid enough to put your hand in a pair of gloves without checking it, and it has crawled in, then yes, you'll probably get bitten. Garen also warned of other hiding spots, such as jackets that have been hanging up for many months before being put on. The bite of a brown recluse spider often has one of two effects on its victim. In most cases, the antibodies of a person's body will usually keep the bite's harm to a minimum, often without the person even knowing that he's been bitten. Now, the second scenario sees the spider's toxin activate white blood cells to the point of destroying the tissue. It's actually the body's own immune system reacting to the bite that causes the damage. Now, the fangs of a brown recluse are so small they only penetrate between the layers of the skin. And Garen said that he was awarded the research money, and students, or 10 UA PhD students, worked on the study, not to find a cure for the bite, but rather for cancer research. The hope was to concentrate the toxin on cancerous cells. Research on laboratory mice was not helpful because the mice do not have the same amount of white blood cells as humans. But Garen said that the mice did die from the spider's bites. Now, the first report on brown recluse bites being potentially harmful was not made until 1957. The fact that many people were never aware that they had been bitten made it difficult to pin the blame on the brown recluse spider. Garen said sprays that kill spiders will work, but only if applied during the night hours when they're out hunting for food and water. There will be a pie supper and auction at the Pettigrew Community Center at 7 p.m. on Saturday to help with the expenses incurred by the Evans family. Now, there was no mention in this article of charcoal or DC voltage treatment. Now, I did a series of articles here some time back on DC voltage treatment and charcoal, which will soak up that spider's venom. That's what we use around here is charcoal. Hey, here's a second story that has just come out on the Israeli nuclear incident. Listen to this story. For the second time in the past 2 weeks, Israelis in a moving van have been detained near a U.S. nuclear facility. This time it was the Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base near St. Mary's, Georgia. Security scare shuts Kings Bay, reported the Jacksonville Times-Union on Saturday. Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base was locked down for security reasons on Friday after two Israelis were detained for questioning. Two Israeli men attempted to enter the base about 10:30 a.m. on the pretext that they had been hired by a moving and storage company to pick up household goods at an address on the base, the paper reported. One occupant of the vehicle was unable to provide base security personnel with proper credentials, a base spokesman later told reporters. Base personnel then inspected the van. What the MPs found was no doubt, or has no doubt, since become highly classified. But before that could happen, a base spokesman had blurted this much of it out. A briefcase was removed from the vehicle with a remote control robot, but nothing was found in it. Now, this is the second time that two Israelis, that is, Israel citizens, have been caught in the United States with a Ryder truck up to no good, up to something, but we don't know what it was. Both cases, they were close to nuclear facilities. The last one, they were in a Ryder truck, and they had false identification and a few other things in there. I forgot the full gist of the story. You know, I would say that the Mossad is up to no good, wouldn't you? Here's a little story comes out of Florida, St. Petersburg Times, on handgun range lawsuits. Listen to this. The two bills were pushed by the National Rifle Association and then signed by Governor Jeb Bush on Thursday. The gun range owners will get immunity from lead cleanup lawsuits under certain conditions, and police will be banned from keeping electronic lists of law-abiding gun owners under the bill signed Thursday by Governor Jeb Bush. The National Rifle Association, praising Bush for signing the bills, both of which were pushed by the gun owners group. The gun range bill arose out of a Pinellas County lawsuit that sought to force a range, a gun range, to clean up lead that collected on the ground from expended bullets. Environmentalists say that if the lead leaches into the groundwater, it can be dangerous. I underlined the words, it can be dangerous. You know, I think we're suffering from stupidity here, terminal insanity. The measure is called SB 1156, which Bush signed in a private ceremony. Basically, it bans such lawsuits, making it a misdemeanor for government officials to bring a claim against a gun range for the cleanup of old ammunition. Now, the bill, however, requires state environmental regulators to set up a protocol for how gun ranges should prevent lead contamination of their property and nearby land and water. Among the ideas that will be part of the plan is the use of lead-free ammunition. Now, if these ranges follow the plan, they cannot be sued. And if they don't, they wouldn't be protected from state lawsuits, and neighbors affected by lead entering groundwater could still sue them. Ranges following the proposed management practices would be expected to work with the state to cover the cost of lead contamination cleanup under the measure. The law didn't provide any additional funding source for that. And the bill also withdraws any state suits against gun ranges, which specifically applies to the Skyway Gun Club in Pinellas County, which is being sued by the Southwest Florida Water Management District. The Water Management District owns land adjacent to the Skyway Club and said it was worried about lead pollution in a pond on its property. They didn't say that they found lead in it. They said they were worried about it. They didn't say that the lead on these gun ranges was dangerous. They said it could be dangerous. Well, it could be, maybe. We think that. We theorize. We're worried that. There's no basis for bringing a lawsuit against somebody. and impairing their property. Now, let me tell you what's going on here. These environmentalists are not concerned at all about the environment or the lead leaching into the groundwater. That's stupid. Come on, boys and girls. There's more lead in one car battery than there is in thousands of rounds of bullets. What about lead mines? You know, there's lead in the ground all over Missouri that does not leach into the groundwater. The purpose of these kinds of suits are to harass gun owners and gun clubs and to put on obnoxious restraints and controls to limit their use of firearms. That's the purpose behind it. Nothing more, nothing less. Now, under another bill, HB 155, police and government agencies could be fined $5 million if they keep electronic lists of people who own firearms. That's a step in the right direction. The NRA pushed that one, too, saying some police agencies were compiling databases of law-abiding citizens who owned guns from paper records submitted by pawn shops. Now, the measure doesn't apply to lists created as part of a criminal investigation, and paper pawn records will continue to be available to investigators. Originally, the measure was opposed by police, but lawmakers put in exemptions meant to appease them. Records are needed as part of an ongoing investigation, for example, and can still be put into the database. Now, personal information from a driver's license must remain private unless the driver authorizes its release under a bill Governor Jeb Bush signed into law Thursday. You can forget about that. There's nothing personal or private about the information on a driver's license. That's like a banker telling you, we protect the privacy of our customers. We don't give that information to the IRS unless we get a court order. Well, Mark Twain used to say, you know, there's liars, damn liars, and statistics. That's one of those damn lies. All right, here's another story here, a press release. Vietnam combat disabled veterans Jerry Berry and Dale Van Leuven are discovering that the Department of Veterans Affairs and the many national veteran service organizations are unwilling or unable to enforce existing federal laws protecting veterans' benefits. So within the past 12 months, both Berry and Van Leuven have been ordered to pay their ex-wives alimony from their VA disability compensation. According to U.S. Code Title 38-5301A, VA disability compensation is totally protected from consideration and or attachment in any civil case. The problem is getting anyone to enforce this federal law, Van Leuven stated. Now, I got to pause right there. I get excited now. Here's a problem, and these boys probably had lawyers. Now, remember I said earlier, when you hire a lawyer, the lawyer's job is to keep trouble and litigation going as long as possible. Now, here's a federal statute that comes under the Supremacy Clause. Federal law is superior to state law. So when a state judge does something like this, he can be enjoined. And it's a simple matter. But the lawyers that these two guys have act like, well, I can handle your divorce from you, but gee, it's not my fault that the judge seized your disability payments in violation of federal law. Oh, God, that's a federal case. And, you know, this lawyer is going to come up with a second fee and a second case, which should have been handled routinely in this divorce case. Now, the judge has to have this statute brought in a motion separately. And if the judge continues, you take it up on appeal to your state court of appeals. It's what we call an appealable error. And you simply cite to the appeals court, hey, look what happened here. This judge made an error. He assigned this portion of this veteran's property as alimony, and it violates federal law. Then you take it to your state Supreme Court, and then ultimately, you can go into federal district court in a separate suit on a writ of prohibition or to the U.S. Supreme Court on appeal. You know, what's easy can be turned into a bonanza with a lawyer. And why, I'll be right back. All right, we're back for the closer. You're listening to the Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. Your support of Truth Radio and of our advertisers and sponsors is important to us, so for more information about Truth Radio Network programming, please go to our website. That's truthradio.com, truthradio.com. Truth Radio Network is a private volunteer organization. We're established as a private charitable trust for the purpose of exercising and defending free speech. Truth Radio is not a 501c3 tax-exempt institution. Donations are not tax-deductible. And if they were tax-deductible, we wouldn't be free to tell the truth. So instead, we rely upon the financial support that comes from you, the listening audience, to help us pay for our satellite time, internet audio streaming, and our overhead costs. And we want to thank you very much for that financial support. It comes through your donations that you make to Truth Radio, P.O. Box 344, Napomo, California, 93444. Once more, that's Truth Radio, P.O. Box 344, Napomo, N-I-P-O-M-O, California, 93444. Here's tonight's wise old saying. If all of the economists in the world were laid end to end, they still wouldn't reach a conclusion. All right, let me give you a program note. The Editorial Review will air its last program on Friday, May 28th, beginning Sunday, May 30th. The Law Hour will change its forum or format to 365 broadcasts per year, one a day, 1 hour a day, 7 days a week, starting Sunday, May the 30th. And we will do these broadcasts on compact disc here in our studio in Isabella, Missouri, here at the law school, and then send those out to Austin, Texas, where they'll be put up on the internet. And then that's for the radio stations to take it down. What we have a problem with here is the quality of the sound that comes off of this analog telephone. See, I'm out here in the countryside. We don't have digital. We're just a step above a crank on the wall. So in order to solve that problem, we're going to change our format. And at the same time, I've been doing the Editorial Review now for a year as a fill-in for Truth Radio. So it's time now to bring that program to a close, and I'm going to continue on with the Law Hour, which we've been doing now for about 5 years. And we want to expand that to a larger audience by way of AM and FM affiliates around the world. So there's the program note. Now, let me tell you a little story here about this last story that I mentioned to you just before the break. Here's a guy. This fellow's name, Barry, was ordered by a Georgia Superior Court judge, Alan Keeble, to pay $24,000 in alimony from his VA disability compensation to his ex-wife. Now, he has appealed his case and will appear before Judge Keeble on June 10, 2004. This is why I've pointed out for years that whenever you hire an attorney, he'll keep this case in litigation, he'll keep nickeling and diming you to death until hell freezes over. Like a doctor. You go to a doctor, you never get well. He just keeps telling you, well, I'll come back in 2 weeks. Well, I'll come back in 2 weeks. Well, I'll come back and let me look at it. Well, I'll come back and let me give you another test. You know, every time you come back, it's money in the cash register. Lawyers do the same thing. You never find a doctor, you know, that says, don't come back again, you're cured, you're well. Don't come back unless you get sick. They don't do that. Lawyers don't either. Lawyers will keep you in litigation forever. Now, this is a clean-cut, simple case. And it comes under what's called the Supremacy Clause. And this judge, had this been pointed out to him in a motion, all he needed was a simple motion for a corrective instruction, a motion for a corrective order. The judge would have corrected it under the Supremacy Clause. Now, lawyers are very crafty. They don't solve the problem early on when it needs to be solved. They ignore it. They jump up and down, make you believe they're doing a wonderful job for you. They tell you, God, I can't believe that dumb judge did that. And then they proceed on to dig the hole deeper so that you'll spend more money. That's why I've contended for years that you ought to write that marriage contract before you get married. And notice that this guy got a marriage contract. He's got a divorce coming up, doesn't he? Well, the divorce is regulated by the state. It's a three-party limited general partnership between the boy, the girl, and the state. Well, now, when the boy and the girl got ready to get married, why didn't you get married and leave the state out of the game altogether, draw up a contract between the boy and the girl, and go from there? In this case, this is protected by law anyway. But, you know, you're going to do a lot better in life representing yourself pro se. It's kind of like hiring a plumber. Plumbers are expensive, carpenters are expensive, electricians are expensive, and that's why more people do it themselves. Do it yourself, you know, has been an American institution for generations now. And we ought to be practicing do-it-yourself law. That's an easy case. That's an easy subject there to solve. Those boys shouldn't have to give up their federally protected benefits. But, you know, you can give it up to your ex-wife under a bad state order, or you can give it up to the lawyers. Any way you look at it, the lawyer is going to take his cut out of it. I like to cut both the lawyer and the ex-wife out of it. And if you're an ex-wife and you want to go to law school, that's all right. Then we'll cut the lawyer and the ex-husband out of it. Doesn't make any difference. Whichever you prefer. Let's take a look at soda. Soda pop. Here's a good one. You know, carbonated drinks may raise the risk of esophageal cancer, a usually fatal disease, researchers reported on Monday. Now, this esophageal cancer, over the past 25 years, the incidence rates of esophageal cancer have risen more than 570% in white American men. Esophageal cancer affected 14,000 men and women in 2003, more than 10,000 men, and killed almost all of them. Boy, that's a statistic. 10,000 men got esophageal cancer, killed almost all of them, according to the American Cancer Society. Several studies presented at a meeting of cancer and gastrointestinal experts in New Orleans showed that what people eat and drink could affect a range of cancers, and this research supports the widespread medical recommendations for healthy eating. The rise in esophageal cancer, it's a team at Tata Memorial Hospital in India that found a strong correlation between the rise in per capita consumption of carbonated soft drinks over the past 50 years and a documented increase in rates of esophageal cancer in the United States. Team members studied U.S. Department of Agriculture data to find the per capita consumption of carbonated drinks rose by more than 450%, from 11 gallons on average in 1946 to 50 gallons in the year 2000. So we're drinking more and more soda pop, and it looks like, you know, esophageal cancer isn't that big a deal, but when you get it, evidently it kills you nearly every time. Kind of like penile cancer, you know, we were talking about that not too long ago here on the Law Hour in connection with circumcision. Now, the number of esophageal cancer cases clearly followed the rise in intake of carbonated soft drinks, the researchers found. And that could be a coincidence, but they also found research that showed a possible biological basis for this cause and effect. Carbonated soft drinks cause the stomach to distend, which in turn causes the gastric reflux associated with esophageal cancer. Don't they call this reflux disease, for which they give you the purple pill or something? Ever occur to us that maybe if we'd stop drinking soda pop, We wouldn't need the purple pill. We wouldn't get esophageal cancer. We could solve our own problem. But you know, that's no good. My God, we just got to have our Coca-Cola and Pepsi, don't we? You know, every time you break a law, you know, there's a penalty to pay. Evidently, there's a natural physical law here, a physical barrier. Don't cross here, evidently. Now, the researchers found similar trends worldwide. Countries with per capita annual consumption of more than 20 gallons of fizzy soft drinks also had rising rates of esophageal cancer. Now, the surprisingly strong correlation demonstrates the impact of diet patterns on health trends. Now, another study showed a potential benefit from drinking coffee and other caffeinated beverages, caffeine. A team at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Disease studied people with high risk of liver problems and found that those who drank more caffeine had fewer liver abnormalities. That's just special. They surveyed 6,000 adults at high risk for liver damage because of heavy drinking, hepatitis infection, and iron overload or obesity. The more coffee they drank, the more likely they were to have normal liver function, the researchers found, and these results warranted further study, said Dr. James Everhart, who helped lead the study. Well, it's always good to know that some of our vices have a good side effect. Here's a closer. 3 years after breaking ground, Renewable Environmental Solutions is converting turkey waste from the local butterball plant into oil, gas, and other marketable products at an operation that is the first of its kind in this country. We have proven this technology works, and RES was formed to commercialize the technology, and ConAgra is the owner of Butterball. The plant was opened Wednesday to reporters and photographers. With its maze of pipes, the plant looks like an oil refinery, which it is, said Brian Apple. He's the chairman and chief executive officer. The plant has begun processing 200 tons of waste, blood, bone, offal, feathers, and more. What Butterball generates daily and now is being converted into 100 to 200 barrels of oil a day. The oil is sold to a local company that blends it with its fuel for power generation. RES is not naming the local company, citing prior proprietary reasons. Apple and Samsung said the plant has a capacity for 500 barrels a day that could be sold to utilities, fuel blenders, or even to oil refineries. The RES plant will also generate other products from the poultry waste. For example, fatty acids could be used for cosmetics and lubricants, and carbon could be used in filters and fertilizer. Samson said the procedures are still being refined for maximum production. Methane, which also is produced during the process, is used to fuel the plant's boilers, generating the heat needed to complete the process. A small thermal oxidizer, similar to but more efficient than an incinerator, is on site for odor control. The RES plant uses what is called a thermal conversion process. Here's a first in recycling waste products. Good for them. All right, we're out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. The Law Hour Editorial Review. Thanks for listening. Until then, good night.